Here you go.
Okay. Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. And the title of my lecture tonight is, as David mentioned, The Major Import of Minor Characters in the Elisha Story Cycle. So this lecture is drawn from a chapter in my dissertation in which I analyze minor characters in the Elisha stories utilizing the tools of literary criticism. I have chosen to focus on literary aesthetic features, not only to draw out the beauty and the artfulness of these stories, but also because I believe that how the story is crafted gives insight into its themes. The anonymous author of the Elisha stories wished to convey a message of profound theological depth to encourage the people of his day, and the themes he has sown into the stories become abundantly clearer when we understand how carefully they are woven into the story. The primary literary feature we will look at tonight is the author's use of character. While I believe these stories to be historically accurate, the questions that one taking an historical critical approach to the Bible might ask are necessarily different from those taking a literary critical approach. So as such, my primary focus of research is not the history behind the stories, rather the literary features and the theological themes that can be discerned. So where are we headed tonight? First, I will give you some background into my interest in studying minor characters in the Bible in general and in the Elisha story in particular. Second, I will set the table for analyzing the Elisha stories by delving a little bit into the historical context to help our understanding of some of the social dynamics that are at play in the stories. And finally, we will analyze two or three stories that exemplify two different types of minor characters. In my dissertation, I analyze about seven of each type, but I think two will suffice for tonight. Using a literary term for characterization called an agent, which I will explain shortly, I will analyze two groupings of minor characters. First, direct appeal agents approach Elisha with the problems of everyday life. They come full of faith that Elisha is both willing and able to help them. They receive not only solutions, but empowerment and encouragement as the prophet involves them in the execution of individual miracles on their behalf. Typically, the prophet calls on them from their own resources to participate in the execution of the miracle or other act of deliverance. Second, agents of prophetic referral share timely wisdom with kings and other elite, correcting their errors of judgment to resolve the presenting threat or dilemma. Many refer their superiors to Elisha, while others wisely and gently provide a critical advice to a superior who is on the verge of making a foolish decision. When the hesitant or faltering leader takes their advice, the narrative events unfold in alignment with divine providence. Unknowingly, these well-intentioned servants achieve a higher purpose than they intend. And just to clarify, by these categorizations, I do not intend to create new literary genres that are absolute, but I use these terms as convenient groupings that will aid in the analysis and unique features of these characters and their stories. So why minor characters? The focus of this lecture will not necessarily be about the prophet Elisha himself. Rather, I'm going to talk about the minor characters that appear in the Elisha stories. In my dissertation, I use the term minor secondary characters to express how minor these characters really are. So neither will I be focusing on the Shunammite woman, or Gehazi, or even Naaman, because I consider these major secondary characters. And I want to focus on the nameless characters, who appear only for a brief moment in the stories, but who have a great impact on its outcome. I define a minor secondary character as one that appears once or twice in the Bible, and either plays a minor role in a story or possibly a leading role in a very short story, that is about seven verses or less. A great and diverse cast in the Elisha stories feature many common Israelites and foreigners, besides kings, high officials, and the prophet himself. I contend that one narrative function of the minor secondary characters in the Elisha story cycle is to express its central theological themes. Some of these key theological themes include the following. Despite appearances, God is actively working to deliver and preserve his people. Rather than consigning his people to suffer as helpless victims, they have been assigned an active role and the participation of Elisha's miraculous deeds. The minor characters portray ordinary people as empowered. Although they do not wield prophetic power, they can participate in the miracles through their active obedience and contribute to the welfare of their people by dispensing timely insights to their leaders. Relative to their cursory appearance in each story, their impact on its outcome is prodigious. One of the limitations in analyzing such minor characters is their relatively low level of characterization. The biblical author portrays each character with just enough depth to fulfill their role in the story. We have all heard of the terms round and flat characters. Flat characters are two-dimensional, they don't change throughout the course of a literary work. Round characters, on the other hand, are more complex. They grow and develop and are typically the focus of a literary work. Adele Berlin, a biblical scholar, defines a third category, the agent, which has the lowest level of characterization. According to Berlin, agents are, and I quote, not important for themselves, and nothing of themselves, their feelings, etc., is revealed to the reader. The reader cannot relate to them as people. They are there for the effect that they have on the plot or its characters. They are necessary for the plot, or serve to contrast or to provoke responses from the characters. End quote. In other words, agents are not consequential in their own right, since they exist only as an accessory to the plot or to characterize the majors. Their literary function of minor characters, who often portray peasants, servants, and other common people, often mirrors their function in real life. They wait upon the major characters they serve to appear and disappear as necessary. An example of this phenomenon is the role of Abraham's two servants in Genesis 22. Have you ever noticed in the story that Abraham takes two servants with him and Isaac to Mount Moriah? They set off with Abraham and Isaac, balancing the cast of four characters, father, son, and two servants. Arguably, the most important thing that they do is to disappear from the story without so much as a word, while the father and son go off together alone to Mount Moriah. Their silent disappearance focuses the reader on the relationship between father and son, conveying a sense of intimacy. Instead of encumbering the reader with non-essential details about minor characters, the author focuses the reader on the principal characters and the action of the plot. While indeed one of the functions of agents is to accentuate certain personality traits of the principals by means of contrast, I maintain that the minor characters in the Elisha story cycle not only provide indirect characterization of Elisha and other round characters, but they also make a direct contribution to the thematic message. The sheer number and diversity of minor characters appearing in a variety of roles in the Elisha narratives is an exception to the biblical reductionism of dramatis personae. While some of these minor characters might be considered agents, according to Berlin's definition, many of them are portrayed with just a bit more color, a touch more depth of emotion, wisdom, and faith. Although many feature in just one or two verses, the author has managed to create a realistic minor character with minimal means of portrayal that is typical of the biblical narrative. So why did I focus on minor characters, the agents, in the Elisha stories and not in the stories of his predecessor, Elijah? First, a word about the difference in the personality of these two wonder-working prophets of God. Elijah, pictured here, casting his mantle on the shoulders of Elisha, is nearly always portrayed as independent and solitary, the lone prophet contending for the sole worship of the Lord God. Elijah escaped to Wadi Karit to be fed by ravens alone. He battled the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel all by himself. Then, leaving his servant behind, he walked 40 days in the desert to Mount Horeb, where he insisted to God twice that he was the only one in all Israel who remained faithful to him. Elisha, on the other hand, is always portrayed interacting with other people, not only with kings and court officials, but most often with ordinary people from different walks of life. The reader's first impression of Elisha is his care for these ordinary people. When Elijah casts his mantle on Elisha, he understands it is a lifetime call to serve the Lord. In response to the prophetic call, Elisha slaughters the oxen he has been plowing with. treats the people to a barbecue, then kisses his parents goodbye. Elisha interacts with townspeople, bands of prophets, servants, women, foreigners, as well as generals and kings. Despite a few episodes that recall his fire-brandishing predecessors, such as the bears and the boys of Bethel, Elisha is everywhere to be found busily engaged in helping people of all backgrounds with their various problems. Elisha is consistently reliable. He helps every person who appeals to him, even begrudgingly those he disapproves of. Elisha is consistently available and willing to render assistance to the king, the foreign soldier, the poor widow, or the whole nation, if need be. One scholar compared Elisha to a magnet drawing needy people to himself. And so I believe the minor characters in Elisha's stories in particular have a special significance. Even though Elisha is one of Israel's most powerful and charismatic prophets, ordinary people play a critical role in these stories. While the miracles of Elisha are surely captivate the reader, the faith and action of minor characters is central to the successful outcome of many of the stories. Before we can go on, a few comments on the historical context will be helpful for understanding the background. The setting of the Elisha stories is the 9th century BC in the kingdom of northern Israel. In the late 10th century BC, after the reign of Solomon, Israel was divided into the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. Immediately following the division, the kingdom of Israel, highlighted here in purple, was characterized by relative social equality, decentralized and unorthodox worship of the Lord, and political instability, as northern royal dynasties frequently succumbed to coup d'etat. Around 885, Omri, an Israelite army commander, led a successful revolt against Zimri, who himself had conspired against the previous king and assassinated him a mere 7 days earlier. After consolidating his kingdom, Omri made alliances with his Phoenician neighbors to the north, a significant shift in international policy from that of his predecessors. His more famous son and successor Ahab followed suit, marrying a Sidonian princess, Jezebel. The Omrides created a stable monarchic dynasty and ended a half century of interclan strife, but they also introduced wide-ranging religious and economic changes to northern Israel, such as state-sponsored worship of Phoenician deities, participation in the international export market. Accompanying these changes, two economic developments resulted in the deprivation of Israel's peasantry, the working class. One was the development of a standing army and chariot force. The Kirk monolith inscription of Assyrian King Shalmaneser III lists the military strength of his foes, among which was the kingdom of northern Israel. According to that inscription, King Ahab commanded a force of 2,000 chariots and 10,000 foot soldiers. The development of a standing army, among other factors, created a demand for horses and the means to support them. The cultivation of pasture land for hay and straw strained economic resources, leaving many in extremis. The other development was a process of land accumulation in the hands of a few wealthy landowners to the deprivation of the peasantry, called latifundialization. Self-sufficient family farms would be bought up by wealthy and transformed into larger, more efficient commercial farms, producing wine and oil that would have been ideal at cash crops for export. Latifundialization would have resulted in an impoverished landless peasant class with no means to sustain themselves in times of war or natural disaster. Many of these developments can be seen in the biblical text, but some are merely hinted at. The introduction of state-sponsored worship of Baal and other Phoenician deities was a distinguishing mark of Ahab's reign and was the focus of the prophet Elijah's opposition. The establishment of foreign trade is inferred in 1 Kings 20, where Aramean king Ben-Hadad invites King Ahab to establish markets in Damascus, indicating that the infrastructure for international trade was already in place. The establishment and maintenance of a standing army can be seen in the narratives describing the wars between Aram and Israel during King Ahab's reign in 1 Kings chapter 20 and 22. Additionally, in 1 Kings 18, Ahab launches into a search for pasture land for horses during a drought, indicating the priority of standing chariot force over the needs of the people. Latifundialization may be seen in the story of Naboth's vineyard, where King Ahab and Queen Jezebel conspire to wrest Naboth's vineyard, his family land, from his hands. However, the buying and conglomeration of land by royalty is not clearly attested until a century later in the southern kingdom of Judah in the prophetic books of Isaiah and Micah. These policies would have succeeded in achieving prosperity for a privileged few, but the majority of the population would have been marginalized and impoverished from these substantial societal changes. Family farms were acquired, perhaps forcefully, and consolidated into larger estates, as in the story of Naboth's vineyard. Although new advances in technology, such as the widespread production and use of iron implements, brought about advances in agriculture, these implements were unaffordable for landless peasants, as is demonstrated by the grief of the prophet who loses a borrowed axe head in 2 Kings chapter 6. Without a base of economic support in the tribal inheritance, widows and orphans became particularly susceptible to debt slavery, as shown in the desperation of the prophet's widow, which we will read together shortly. Additionally, the population was constantly under the threat of war. Victims were subject to exile and slavery, suffered subhuman conditions during siege warfare. Even during times of relative peace, natural disasters such as drought and famine ensured that the population lived constantly in the shadow of death by starvation. While kings and other elite also endured hardships during this period, such conditions ensured that peasants were even more susceptible, since resources for militarization competed with the scant resources available for ordinary people. That King Ahab sends Obadiah out looking for pasture land to feed his chariot horses during a 3.5-year drought is a negative testimony to a people silently starving. So, in light of this introduction and historical background, my thesis is as follows. Frequently, ordinary townspeople, servants, mothers, foreigners, and those on the margins of society make a pivotal contribution to the ministry of Elisha. The affirmative portrayal of ordinary people ascribes worth and importance to the marginalized of society and serves as a subtle critique to kings, military leaders, and other power brokers in society. In many of these stories, kings and military generals are shown to be dependent on the ordinary people serving them. In a period when ordinary Israelites were increasingly marginalized, impoverished, and oppressed as a result of damaging royal policies introduced by the kings of northern Israel in 9th century, the ministry of Elisha is an overall boon to the Israelite society because he empowers ordinary folk to play their role in Israel's salvation history, using the resources that are at their disposal. Finally, these stories convey a powerful theological message that through the unique portrayal of ordinary folk, the inexorable purposes of God for Israel and for the nations are fulfilled not only through powerful figures and great miracles, but also through simple acts of obedience carried out by humble and faithful people. The first group of minor characters we will examine are examples of faithfulness in the Elisha story cycle, whom I call direct appeal agents, because they each approach the prophet Elisha personally with a request. The author portrays them with a few critical brushstrokes of color and personality as examples of faithful and obedient followers. The reader can easily identify with their situation, understand their attitude, and imitate their actions. Each of the minor characters faces a significant problem. While they do not share Elisha's divine insight or power, they have faith that Elisha, the man of God, is able to solve the problem they are currently facing. Also, they each have direct access to the prophet. In each case, Elisha listens to their complaint and furnishes a miracle to solve the problem. In a direct appeal miracle story, a miracle is wrought in response to a personal appeal made by the character who is in need. As such, at times I will refer to direct appeal agents as suppliants. Those who appeal to Elisha are characterized by great diversity: kings, villagers, widows, prophets, and foreigners all approach the Israelite prophet alike. Elisha provides a miraculous solution that resolves the problem for everyone that appeals to him. The benefits of his prophetic power seem to know no bounds, limits, or conditions. The minimum level of faith required is just enough that a person approach Elisha with their problem and execute his instructions. No other moral or religious conditions are a factor in Elisha's granting the request. Although he wouldn't be considered an agent for my purposes, the Aramean Naaman exemplifies this ideal, since Naaman is healed prior to professing his faith in God. Typically, there are four elements of a direct appeal miracle story, and they include 1. The obedience of a minor character to a prophetic command. 2. Physical material that the prophet uses to perform the miracle. 3. The prophetically uttered word of the Lord. And 4. A prophetic action involving the physical material. The presence of each of these four plot elements on the interaction between prophet focuses the interaction between prophet and minor character, rather than the interaction between the prophet and God. For every solicited miracle, Elisha enlists the participation of the minor character who approaches him. Elisha involves the will, obedience, and resources of these characters in the execution of the miracle. Therefore, these characters are not merely passive observers, but are active participants in their own deliverance. Instead of a one-man show, Elisha, the man of God, involves ordinary people in everyday acts of deliverance and salvation. Thus, Elisha affirms the power and the personhood of each man or woman who appeals to him, making divine power accessible to ordinary people through the prophet as mediator. Such a powerful message would have revitalized the ostracized, faithful to the Lord, and impoverished peasants languishing under the Omrite kings. These four elements are put together in a simple plot outline consisting of 3 parts. First, the presentation of the problem. Second, the presentation of the solution. And 3, the resolution. The suppliant simply states the problem to the prophet, leaving his or her request implied. The suppliant never proposes solutions that require divine intervention. Thus, the presentation of the solution is always given to the prophet. Elisha enlists their obedience and their resources, their required physical material, to execute the miraculous solution. The prophet then performs the miracle or directs the suppliant to perform action that will accomplish the miracle. Usually, although not always, this involves a particular prophetic action, for example, throwing the physical material and declaring the word of the Lord. The story concludes with a short narrative exposition confirming that the miracle indeed occurred and resolved the problem. That's our first story. The story of the healing of the waters at Jericho in 2 Kings chapter 2 is paradigmatic in the Elisha story cycle. The story opens abruptly with a problem without any backstory. The men of the city are introduced by their speech. They address Elisha with a brief and direct presentation of the problem. Although the site of the city is good, the water is bad, causing the land to be unfruitful. Literally, the Hebrew word means causes bereavement or miscarriage. The men are portrayed as polite and reverent. They address Elisha in the third person as my Lord. Their request that Elisha help them is implied in the description of the problem and the disparity between the good site and the bad waters. After the problem is briefly presented, the story immediately precedes the presentation of the solution. Elisha responds to their implied request by commanding the men to bring him a new bowl and to put salt in it. Elisha's response to a perceived need without waiting for a specific request will be paradigmatic for the story cycle. The men act in obedience to his command, even though logically, adding salt to the water would exacerbate the problem. In retrieving these items, the men of Jericho affirm their faith that Elisha can solve their problem despite the illogic of his request. Additionally, they become participants in the healing miracle, not merely observers. The prophet does not heal the waters alone, but he elicits the cooperation of the people of Jericho. Having enlisted their obedience and collected the requested physical material, the first two ingredients of the prophetic miracle, the story proceeds towards resolution. Elisha goes to the source and throws the salt in and declares the water source healed according to the word of the Lord. The prophetic action here, as in several other stories, involves throwing the requested physical material. The word of the Lord is delivered by the prophet in the first person. I have healed these waters. The word healing can be associated with fertility, countering the infertility or barrenness of the land. A narrative exposition confirms the lasting effect of the miracle on the spring. The waters have been healed to this day, according to Elisha's spoken word. And indeed, you can go down today and draw water from there. As paradigmatic story, all four elements of the direct appeal miracle story are present. The physical material, obedience of the second manic character, prophetic action, and the word of the Lord spoken and reported as fulfilled. Deviation from this pattern in other stories will be critical for the interpretation of each story and will also yield a distinctive theological message of each, as the following intertextual comparison will begin to demonstrate. The story of the healing of the waters of Jericho is similar in many ways to Moses' sweetening of the waters at Marah in Exodus chapter 15. The major difference between the two, as we shall see, is that in the Moses story, the narrative focus is on the exchange between God and the prophet, whereas in the Elisha story, the focus is on the exchange between the prophet and the people. The story begins with a backstory setting up the need for a divine intervention. The people complain to Moses about the bitter waters. Thus, the presentation of the problem is similar to the Elisha story. People in need approach a prophet they know can resolve their problem. Their request is implied from their complaint, but here the stories diverge. At this point, the focus of the story shifts from between prophet and people to between prophet and God. Moses does not address their complaint, but he immediately cries out to the Lord, who shows him a log. Moses understands he has to throw the log in, and the waters become sweet. The passage concludes with the word of the Lord. Thus, the four elements of the miracle, obedience, physical material, prophetic action, and word of the Lord, are all present, but one is significantly altered. Here, Moses obeys an implied command of God to obtain the required physical material, whereas Elisha commands the people to bring it. Additionally, Elisha does not cry out to the Lord, as does Moses. The interaction between God and Elisha is not detailed. Instead, the Elisha story emphasizes how the prophet who performs the miracle to relieve the need of the people draws from their resources, enlisting their participation and obedience. One of the most compelling direct appeal miracle stories is that of the widow and her children, who are on the verge of being sold into debt slavery. The story, found at the beginning of 2 Kings chapter 4, opens immediately with the widow presenting her case to Elisha. With a bare minimum of biographic details, she immediately springs into action, crying out to Elisha. In comparing her with other women in the Bible who cry out for justice, she is exceptional in that she cries out to a prophet and not to the king. Approaching Elisha is recognition of his authority and confidence that he can provide a solution. In light of the oppressive economic policies introduced by the Omri and Ahab and their faithlessness to the Lord, the prophet Elisha is her only recourse and may be the only source for delivering justice to the people of Israel. As in the previous story, the suppliant does not propose a solution, but uniquely, Elisha asks her what she has in her house. Instead of demanding a specific object as before, Elisha shows a willingness to work with whatever the widow has. Because she is destitute and appears to have no resources at her disposal, Elisha will fully involve her and her family in the working of the miracle. In this story, there is a slight twist to the presentation of the solution. Instead of asking the woman to bring her sole possession, a jug of oil, to him, he sends her out to borrow additional jugs and jars from all her neighbors and then go directly home to begin pouring. That the widow is to borrow vessels is significant. She is not a beggar, for ultimately she will return them. This time, Elisha will not perform the miracle, nor will he be present. Rather, the widow and her children will do so behind the closed door of their house. Compared to other stories, her task is significantly more difficult. Her participation much more involved. The narrative portrays her as fully active, while the prophet directs and observes to maximize her role in the miraculous deliverance. As the suppliant with the greatest need and the least means, she is most in need of empowerment. Elisha not only provides for her material needs, but also honors her and elevates her status in society by enabling her to become a contributing member. Elisha commands her not to limit her borrowing of vessels to just a few, for the extent of the miracle will be contingent on her effort. Thus, Elisha not only involves the widow and her children, he empowers them by enlisting their resources, energy, and relationships with other families. The resolution contains a firestorm of feminine verbs. She went, she closed, she poured, she said, she came, she told. Go, sell, pay, and live are all feminine verbs. Though a minor character in the story cycle, the widow is the main actor in this story. No doubt their entire village would have wondered at this destitute widow and her children collecting empty jars and would have been surprised to purchase them from her full of oil at the local market. What was performed behind closed doors would not have remained secret for long. What appears to be Elisha's first miracle for an individual would have been celebrated by the whole community. Furthermore, the miracle is one of overabundance, as indicated by the words, the rest. Not only does the miracle provide for the family with a way of escaping debt slavery, their immediate and pressing concern, but it also provides sufficient income for them to live on after they are liberated from debt slavery. While the obedience of the minor characters and the physical material feature largely in this story, prophetic action is limited to his verbal commands and the authority of the Lord implied by the established prophet, whom the author now calls man of God for the first time in the cycle. In the direct appeal miracle stories, Elisha attends to the needs mostly of ordinary people who demonstrate their faith in God by entrusting their problems to the divinely appointed man of God. The stories largely exhibit faithful characters who possess a simple faith that Elisha can do something about a presenting problem without requesting a specific solution from him. By means of comparison, no characters, ordinary or otherwise, appeal to Elijah. Evidently, the common person did not have access to a man of God in Elijah's day. It was more common to register one's petition before God at the temple or other sacred place. However, in the time of Elisha, a significant change took place. Access to divine aid became available not only to those who approached a holy place, but also for those who approached a holy man. Additionally, Elisha's itinerant nature, as can be seen in the map here, where Elisha's stories are highlighted in yellow, ensured that widespread access to that life-giving power, especially for common folk struggling with the problems of everyday life. Elisha provided not only access to divine power, but also encouraged their participation with the prophet as co-partners in the acts of deliverance. None of the minor characters who make their appeal to Elisha directly are spectators in their story. All of them play a role in obeying a command of Elisha, whether difficult or easy, and all of them contribute from their own resources, whether it's simply fetching a bowl of salt or knocking on every door in town to gather her community's resources. Here is a table of all the direct appeal miracle stories that I analyze in my dissertation. The top six. The two we analyzed together are highlighted in red. We see that only in the first story do all four elements of the direct appeal miracle story appear. In the other stories, one or two of these elements is missing or incomplete, showing that each story is unique. The elements of obedience of a secondary character and physical material appear more frequently than the prophetic oracle fulfillment formula or even the action of the man of God himself. Specific action on Elisha's part is only recorded in the stories The Healing of the Waters, which we read, The Cleansing of Deadly Stew, and the raising of an axe head from the Jordan River. In these three stories, the action is always throwing the physical material. In the widow In the widow's oil and the feeding of the 100, all the action is carried out by the secondary characters at Elisha's command. Yet in all six stories, the obedience of secondary characters plays a central role in the enactment of the miracle or the giving of the divine word. Looking ahead to the Naaman story, which we'll read in a moment, we see that Elisha demands the obedience of Naaman involving physical material, that is, bathing in the waters of the River Jordan. Neither prophetic action nor prophetic word of the Lord are in the story. However, these two missing items are precisely what Naaman states should have happened. He expected Elisha to come out to him, to wave his hand about, and to proclaim healing in the name of the Lord, as we shall see shortly. With these differences, certainly reflected in the unique situations of each story as discussed above, the elements that are present in every story display a consistent pattern in Elisha's ministry, helping every suppliant while enlisting their participation. Again, Elisha helps every single person who approaches him with a need, and he involves them in some way in executing the solution. Additionally, although every story contains a supernatural event, the interaction between prophet and the Lord is unstated. Instead, the narrative focuses on the relationship between Elisha and the people and how Elisha cares for all people in need, especially seeking to empower those of little means. The man of God is not only involved in their lives, addressing their various concerns, but he also involves them in the solution to their own problems, consistently addressing those concerns in a way that empowers them, while rewarding them for their simple faith that acknowledges their dependence on God. Those who approach Elisha in faith leave not only with solutions to their problems, but with an experience that has built their faith in God and confidence in their own value and worth as people with a meaningful role to play in God's story. Now we'll move on to our second category, prophetic referral agents. In the Elisha stories, we find several minor characters, for the most part servants of kings and other elite, who play a critical role in the story, though they appear only briefly by referring their boss, who is at a critical crossroads, to the prophet Elisha himself or toward the prophecy of Elisha. I mentioned in the last section that no minor characters appeal directly to Elijah to avail themselves of his miraculous powers. Similarly, no minor characters refer someone in need to Elijah for help when faced with a problem. On the other hand, we see several minor characters pointing their distressed superiors to Elisha. The unique role of minor characters in the Elisha story cycle I call prophetic referral. These characters consistently display wisdom, common sense, and clear-headedness that exceeds that of their leaders to solve a presenting problem. The revelation of their wisdom stimulates movement in the plot and its associated thematic elements on two levels. One, the mundane level, the human level of the presenting issues of the day, and second, the level of divine providence. I define divine providence as the inexorable purposes of God for Israel and the nations that are accomplished through means both ordinary and miraculous by agents both human and divine. The best example is the little Israelite servant girl who suggests to her mistress that Naaman might appear before Elisha. On the mundane level, she knows that her master is in need and that the prophet Elisha is both willing and able to help anyone who approaches him. But on the level of divine providence, her suggestion is provocatively irrational. Although human wisdom would dictate, other than sending one's greatest general behind enemy lines for a doctor's appointment, her advice accorded with the divine plan for Naaman, resulting not only in his healing, but also in his confession of faith in the God of Israel. Whereas the direct appeal agents are rewarded for their own faith, in these stories, kings and other leaders are rewarded for the faith of their subordinates. Their impact is felt primarily through a single critical speech. They frequently enter the narrative the moment the advice is required and silently exit immediately after it is given. Though they appear very briefly, sometimes merely a half verse, their role must not be underestimated. Their literary function or role is to perceive the nature of the dilemma facing a major character and to dispense well-timed advice. When heeded, solves the immediate issue and writes the course of the plot. A modern equivalent is just before a main character in a thriller movie is about to open the closet door where the killer awaits, but she receives a timely phone call from a friend warning her of the impending danger. As such, they function as a deus ex machina, saving the day in the nick of time. In the Elisha story cycle, their advice points the major characters toward the person or the prophecy of Elisha. The major characters, who are either facing their problem irresolutely or intent on making an inauspicious decision, always take their advice, leading to a satisfactory resolution of the plot. Another unique aspect of the prophetic referral characters is that though they are all servants, both Israelite and foreigner alike fulfill the same role. Not only common Israelites, but common Arameans are afforded insight into the workings, words, and will of Elisha, the man of God. Similar minor characters outside the Elisha stories are not always duly heeded. For example, the Levite servant in Judges chapter 19. Theologically, the wisdom these subordinates display derives from their submission to God through reliance on his prophet Elisha. These servants realize that the solution to the problem facing their superiors is beyond human power or intellect. Their solution is elegantly simple. Refer them to the words or person of Elisha, the man of God. The contrast between fumbling superior and wise servant is stark. This contrast subtly discredits kings and high-ranking officials in the eyes of the reader. But more importantly, it subtly elevates the servant, intimating a potential for ordinary folk to play a critical role in God's providence. Ultimately, the stories demonstrate that wisdom and power reside in God alone, and authority figures and ordinary folk alike are exhorted to submit to God's providential rule. The story of Naaman's healing in 2 Kings chapter 5 has been noted for its length, complexity of plot, and a large cast of characters. While the minor characters perform different functions in the narrative, we will focus on the roles of two minor characters who refer Naaman to the prophet and his prophecy, respectively, keeping the Aramean general on track with his destiny with divine providence. Both characters are servants who show great loyalty to Naaman that goes beyond the normal obligation of a servant. Both provide Naaman access to insight that they uniquely possess. Naaman, a powerful general whose skin disease threatens him with social ostracism, is both healed physically and encounters the God of Israel because he listens to the advice of his servants. Ironically, these humble servants not only display naive good sense, but they also offer Naaman a glimpse into the workings of divine providence. Their words carry a mysterious generative power, propelling Naaman across borders into enemy territory to meet the prophet in Israel and follow his unorthodox instructions. Besides the many sharp contrasts between the captive Israelite maidservant and the great Aramean general Naaman, they share two common traits that bind this improbable pair of characters together: suffering and servanthood. Both traits are mentioned in the story's introduction. Standing out from her fellow servants in the Elisha story cycle, the Israelite servant girl merits a narrative exposition in verse 2, her own backstory to explain how she ended up in Naaman's household. Her origin is a history of personal and national suffering. Raiding Arameans have ravaged the people of Israel, and this little girl has been abducted and forced into slavery. Remarkably, instead of remaining captive to fear and resentment, she acts with compassion toward her master. At the end of a long list of accolades in verse 1, we learn that Naaman too is suffering, not from war, but from disease. Another common factor is that Naaman and the little Israelite maidservant are both lifnei, a Hebrew preposition that means before their master. He before Aram's king, she before Naaman's wife. In this story, lifnei carries the dual denotations of physical presence and servanthood. She is the first character to speak in the story, and his speech echoes hers. She expresses her desire to her mistress that Naaman see Elisha, using the interjection, "Would that my lord were before the prophet Elisha in Samaria." The maidservant's knowledge that Elisha is in Samaria provides Naaman with sufficient information to locate him while providing the reader with indirect characterization of the prophet. Even young Israelite girls are familiar with the prophet's whereabouts and his reputation for graciousness and reliability. Finally, like the direct appeal agents, she shows absolute confidence that Elisha will heal Naaman if only he can approach him and be before him, providing additional indirect characterization of Elisha. Although the main denotation of this preposition is certainly a geographical here, the subtle second denotation of Lifne as servanthood is also in view. Although Naaman is submitted to his master, the king of Aram, he must further humble himself before the prophet, who is in Samaria. Thus, the suggestion of the little girl acts as a guide, not only indicating where the mighty general must go, but also who he must become. Her insight is eminently practical, perhaps based on her own witness or experience. As such, she is a purveyor of wisdom. Despite her utter powerlessness from a human perspective, she clearly wields the only sort of power that will have any sway in the story, the power of a servant who is submitted to the will of God. Her absolute trust in the prophet's ability and willingness to heal Naaman generates the opportunity for him to be physically healed by the prophet who serves the God who had guaranteed his military success, solving his immediate and presenting problem. While the Israelite maidservant may not have intended Naaman's submission to God, her insightful suggestion creates this possibility as well. Her superiors receive her advice with utmost credulity. Not only does her advice travel quickly from Naaman's wife all the way up to the king, it is implemented by king and general without delay. When Naaman finally does approach Elisha, he takes offense that Elisha dispatches a servant to meet him with instructions to go bathe in the River Jordan, and he flies into a rage. Narrative pace slows considerably to describe Naaman's tirade in two verses that reveal his expectations of a personal encounter with Elisha and his disgust at being snubbed. He is portrayed as rash, foolishly endangering his own healing and threatening to derail the entire plot. Furthermore, Naaman, embroiled in his own anger, jeopardizes his recognition of God, of the God whose providential hand in his life and international affairs in which he plays a part. His servants, not mentioned in the narrative until now, suddenly spring to life with a line of considerable rhetorical skill that reflects both respect and concern for their enraged master. Before they begin, their speech is introduced by three verbs, and they approached, and they spoke, and they said, showing the care that they take in addressing Naaman. They cautiously but cleverly appeal to Naaman's sense of greatness, first catching his ear. "If a great thing the prophet has spoken to you," they say. And they continue, closing in on their real intention, motivating Naaman to action. "Would you not do it?" Having come a great distance with an enormous wealth, he had already demonstrated his willingness to do a great thing, and he expected to be rewarded with a prophetic show of power. The servant's first question demonstrates their keen insight into their master's temperament. Their second question arrives to their intention. "How much more so that he has told you, wash and be clean?" The servant's insight is penetrating. Their logic is convincing. Their questions honor and challenge their master at the same time. Their request is not only reasonable, but also tactfully and deferentially exposes Naaman's pride, now the only remaining obstacle between him and healing. As arbiters of good sense and encouragement, Naaman's servants invite him to view the matter from their perspective. Though the servants do not display the same level of familiarity and trust in Elisha as the Israelite maidservant, their faith is notable since they, like Naaman, are foreigners. That they give credence to the strange methods of this Israelite prophet who has just offended their master signifies that there is more at stake than just physical healing. The God of Israel is about to reveal himself to a people at war with Israel. Like his wife's maidservant, his own servants come to his rescue. Their groundedness contrasts with his delirium, their simplicity with his flamboyance. Their invitation disarms Naaman, allowing him to overcome his pride and rage, and he immediately heeds their servant wisdom. For a second time in the story, Naaman unequivocally trusts in the words of a servant, whose concern for him and trust in the prophet lead to his well-being. After dipping in the Jordan 7 times, Naaman's skin is transformed from that of a great man to that of a young boy or a little child, a na'ar katan, becoming like the Israelite maidservant, who is described as a young girl, na'ara katana, not only in appearance, but also inwardly, as he humbly submits to his servant's advice and the God of Elisha. While Naaman had immediately perceived the necessity to travel from Aram all the way to Israel, he could not have anticipated the development of his character required of him. The powerful general who arrived with enough silver to buy the hill of Samaria 5 times, with gold and clothing besides, and a clear expectation of how prophets are supposed to heal, has learned that simple obedience is what the prophet requires. And so Naaman becomes a servant himself, to stand before the prophet, as the prophet himself stands before God. His speech reveals his inner transformation. He now humbly refers to himself as your servant when addressing Elisha. Commentator Robert Cohen suggested that the story of Naaman could have been summarized as follows. Naaman, the commander-in-chief of the Syrian army, was valorous but leprous. When he heard of the power of Elisha, he went to Samaria to be cured. Elisha said to him, "If you would be clean, wash 7 times in the Jordan." And Naaman did as the prophet said, and behold, he was clean. Such a summary would cut out all the minor characters in the story, including the 2 agents of prophetic referral. While it provides resolution for the mundane issue of Naaman's physical illness, the abbreviated version of the story that omits the minor secondary characters likewise omits the profound theological themes of the story. Naaman's character transformation and allegiance to God, aligning him with God's purpose for Israel and for the nations. Another theological theme, no less profound, is how the story subtly critiques those who exercise authority by exhibiting the wisdom of common people over their superiors, and by emphasizing the dependence of the great on the small. From our analysis, it is clear that were the minor characters omitted, so too would be the deeper thematic meaning of the story. Naaman is depicted as dependent on his servants. Not only does he need to follow their advice to benefit from Elisha's healing power, but he also uses them as a model. In doing so, the great Aramean military commander comes to know and serve the God who granted him success in the beginning of the story, the God of Elisha and of the little Israelite servant girl. The message of these minor characters is clear. Those who appear to be in power are really powerless unless they assume the posture of a servant and submit to the will of God. Ultimately, Naaman benefits from the wisdom and faith of his wife's Israelite maidservant and from that of his own servants, and his example and theirs endure as a model of faithfulness to God. The story shows that both nameless servants and great generals, both foreigners and Israelites, men and women, captive and free, can align themselves with divine providence if they become servants and submit to the will of God, whether expressed in the words of the prophet or in the words of a humble servant.
Thank you, Daniel. And if you have any questions, then now is the time. Can you repeat?
Starting over.
Any questions? Comments?
Got a small comment.
All right.
It's just something I noticed that you're talking about how the summary of that story was kind of too short to give its full meaning.
Right.
Yeah. It's just something I noticed in the Bible. The Bible, it always says what it has to say in remarkable conciseness.
Right.
It's kind of just, it brings in everything it has to say in a very good way, but no more. So, If it had been like a short summary, it wouldn't have had all that value.
Thanks. Yeah. No, and important details.
Wonderful. That just means that you're very clear and you're able to...
Or have completely confounded them.
Thank you very much. We have a small book here from our anniversary here from Kaspire Center, our 30 years anniversary, Chosen to Follow. So here you go.
Thank you.
And I hope you can enjoy. I don't think you have it, right?
No.
The rest of you can go into the reception and buy it if you're interested.
Or you can borrow it after.
No, you can borrow it afterwards. No, you can go and buy it. A few announcements. Again, I'll remind you, if you want to sign up for our email and our newsletters or whatever we do, you can go out in the kitchen, grab a cup of coffee and some snacks and write your email on the way. Also, I will do now a very non-Israeli thing and advertise for a course we have in April. So who knows who will be here in April, right? But it's a 10-day course about Jesus the Jew, and we will look about how does theology affects the people that are involved in it, and what does it mean that Jesus then was a Jew, now that all of us is not going around like Orthodox Jewish people or something like this. What does it then mean that he was a Jew? So we'll look into this. You can find it on our website, kaspari.com, and also our library that we are sitting in now is open every day from 9 till 4, and you can come here and read. You can take a small stroll around before you leave, so you can get a sense of what we are having here. Yes, next open lecture will be hopefully in October. We don't have anyone in October yet, but we are hoping to find one. Otherwise, it will be the 17th of November with Antoine Lévy, who is a Dominican Messianic French Jew living in Finland. So what's not to like, right? To make our minds come, you know what? So you can come here. He will give us a very good lecture, also he usually does. So thank you, Marie, for letting us borrow your husband tonight, and have a great trip home and enjoy your evening. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the coffee and water and email is out there.